Hey, it's the Next Lander Ramblecast for September the 1st, 2026. I am Brad. Alex is here. Vinny is not here. Vinny's off doing something that's not this, I guess.
Whatever it is, I'm sure he's having a good time.
And yeah, probably.
You know what? I'm so happy September is here. One, because the weather is about to turn. And two, we're almost done this fucking year, man.
Yeah, there's something to that. And I'm sure next year will be
much better. Absolutely.
Yeah. Different and way better.
Yeah.
The future is good.
That's right. That's right. That's the voice of Rob Zachney. Remap Radio's Rob Zachney here in Vinny's place. Rob, welcome to the Ramblecast for, I guess, the first time.
Yeah. Happy to be here. And yeah, I'm probably going to be doing Vinny-esque things later today as I try to unplug an entire like electronic and analog setup and figure out why it has stopped working.
I start to say that you were a good fit for this podcast because you are a man who is given to ramble. And I mean that in the most glowing sense, but mm-hmm. I didn't even have to ask you like, hey, Rob, what's new in life? Cause you already gave me a topic. Let's go. What is your
analog
setup?
What's going on, man?
Oh boy. Where to begin? Basically I have a problem where I am always curious if something can be made a little bit better. True with audio in particular. And that's a hobby, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
it is any sort of hobby. There's sort of like the price performance, like entry level stuff. And then there's like buy up versions where it's like, okay, you're willing to put a little investment into this mental energy, financial, whatever. And then you get into like super marginal, like, here's the Rolls Royce version of this thing. It costs like four times as much as the mid-range thing, and the gains are super dubious.
Your Rune Titans and so forth.
Yeah. We can. We don't need to bring up the Rune Titan. We don't need to discuss that. To be clear, I never bought it. Okay. I don't recommend people do. But so for about a year, I've been very happy with in the last year, I went to basically all separates system. If you know audio stuff, basically, so AV receiver, right? Mm-hmm. That's an integrated system,
right?
That has preamplification, amplification, and then signal input all built into one box,
right?
So HDMIs go in, it is controlling the volume directly on the device, and then it's sending power to speakers, etc. Very basic,
right?
And
if you have a turntable, it's like turntable goes into that and that goes to speakers.
Nope,
and that's
sorry.
It.
Right? We're, right, okay, nope, we're already wrong.
All right,
that is a maybe. Turntables are a weird. This is how I end up here.
Uh-huh.
Turntables are a weird sort of analog device. They plug in through RCA cables,
mm-hmm.
but they do require special amplification. Preamplification, even over and above what a normal preamplifier does. So some AV receivers will have phono stage inputs.
Okay, because I saw you post the words phono stage this weekend. I was primed.
And a lot of them won't have that. And what you'll buy is like, again, you can spend sort of any amount of this. There's like $50 phono amps that like you plug the turntable into that. And then that plugs into RCA jacks on the receiver. Or you can spend like infinite money on a phono stage.
Okay.
But in the last year, I had a perfectly good Anthem integrated receiver. And then, bit by bit, like I was like, yeah, but what if we just had the amplifier kick, signal out to a separate amplifier for the stereo speakers, the big like 6 foot tall Carver speakers I've got.
Let's be clear. These are not your standard like surround speakers you have in your living room. These things could kill a man.
I mean, if these are the same speakers of record that I am familiar with, they have been show art for a Next Lander podcast in the past.
Tall boys.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are substantial. They look like they were carted out of some like feature of antiquity. You know, they were discovered in some ruins somewhere.
Yeah, especially because there's nothing really like them. They're driven by, instead of normal tweeters that you find like on any speaker, you know, the circular like tweeter that you find mm-hmm. the set of like instead of being driven by those, it uses a fancy aluminum foil ribbon to generate sound. So nobody really designed anything like this before or since. They're kind of unusual just from that standpoint. But putting them on a separate power source dedicated power system. I was like, wow, these sound fucking awesome. And then that amplifier failed about a year ago, or it didn't fail. Like a part wore out. And so it needed to go to the shop, but.
So not the Anthem, but the other amplifier that you had going on.
Yeah. Like a vintage okay. NAD, amplifier. So naturally at that point I'm like, well, I found a pretty good deal on Anthem's STR power amplifier and their preamplifier, two things that together usually cost like $12,000. Somebody was selling them from a audio store in Florida. They were floor demo models for a few grand.
Okay. And,
I mean, that's a pretty substantial difference.
Yeah. And so I was like, hook me up.
Practically and giving them away.
Life-changing. This is probably the single, that and getting a really good center speaker were probably the two like most life-changing upgrades I made in the last like year. And these things, they kicked all kinds of ass. And the crucial thing though at that point is now we are starting to separate the system out.
Yeah.
The AV receiver is still there, mostly to deal with video. Now increasing all music stuff now is basically going straight into the preamplifier.
Right.
And then that is feeding it to the amplifier, but like the receiver is basically out of the picture now.
Got it.
For music. And here's the regrettable thing I must tell you. Maybe you don't want to know, but
this is a safe place. You can say get as weird with it as you want.
We're this far in.
Okay. So there's a thing about like audiophiles where like people really love to be smirky about like. It's the monster cables thing, right? It's the fancy cables. So they think that all like audiophile, like fetish objects are like bullshit, that it's all fake and nobody
everything's gold plated and
like, right.
The knobs are specially balanced
the truth is some of them are bullshit, but the thing is there are also devices that are maybe still too much money, but actually do create a demonstrable difference in what you are using.
And that's, and especially if you're talking about analog tech, where that is a thing where like, literally the physical layout of like signal paths and boards, the materials you use, like you can get more and more out of an analog signal path. If you're willing to put in more money, there is a point of diminishing returns. High end audiophile stops so far past that point of diminishing returns. But the regrettable thing is moving to the separate system was not one of those, like I am convincing myself I hear a difference. That was a like, oh shit. Like this is a vastly better way to listen to music. Like this kicks ass. And you could do side by side with the receiver and it was like night and day. So I was like, cool, I'm happy. And the Anthem preamplifier had a phono stage built in and I forget. Oh, I know what it was. So then we have this good setup and we made the mistake of listening to MK and I have like one of our favorite bands when we were first dating was the Walkmen.
Yes. I know them well.
And so we're having a good listening sesh, listening to the new system and all that, and everything sounds fucking amazing. And we're like, let's put on Bows and Arrows. Sounds like shit.
Huh.
Oh no.
And we're sitting there looking at each other, and because the issue is, I remember that album, if you know the track The Rat, right?
I do.
That goes hard. That comes in loud, fast.
It's a loud album. Like it's not like, you know, A Place to Bury Strangers level, like just pure fucking noise. It's not My Bloody Valentine just blowing out your eardrums, but it's a loud album.
But here is the problem, Alex. It is mastered loud. It has no dynamic range whatsoever. And the thing now, especially having seen this band live a few times before they broke up and all that. I listen to that track and I'm listening to it on a really good sound system and you can tell like the band is playing harder. The volume, we're sitting there with a little volume meter in front of us. It stays like rock solid the same. Like it's completely flat. It's coming in. You turn the volume up. It's going to go from like, okay, it went from 70 dB to 71. Now it's 72, but you're in control of that. It is not changing whatsoever.
Huh.
And that sounds really boring. And so we're like, oh no, this isn't good. Did we just like ruin it? And the issue is they're a band from the 2000s and that is sort of your peak. Everything's getting crunched down, to the loudness wars. If you've heard about this concept where everyone's just like mastering stuff really loud and then compressing it so it doesn't get louder or softer. It just comes in at a steady volume. And I've seen various, like, there's two things I've seen it blamed on. One is like earbuds, predominantly like the shift of where people are listening to music, but also like cars and workouts, that music becomes a thing that you are doing while you're doing an activity.
Mm-hmm.
And no, the presumption is absolutely nobody's sitting down listening to music just to like hear it.
Not the way you're doing it.
I've never heard that argument. I had always seen it chalked up to just, it was a war of, I guess, attrition, like on the radio, like just trying to get noticed, basically. Like the louder it was, the more it would catch people's attention.
That was definitely some of the stuff you heard around the 2000s when this started to come through, but it's gotten worse since then as like we entered the smartphone era.
Is it still going? Like, are the loudness wars still raging today?
Well, let me throw a couple of things at you. One, sometimes when I download like high res versions of albums, yep, when I buy them, yep, these days, and sometimes they come in with straight up replay gain stuff built in, where it is like we are taking 5 decibels off every file. Just, it's like baked into the file code. You can turn that off, but it's just sort of like everyone's trying to manage that stuff in different ways. There are people who are also like straight up pirating music that will go in and do their own, like, not remaster, but they will rebalance everything the best way they can. So sometimes you'll download them and be like, hey, I made this sound the way it's supposed to sound, and it's like 10 decibels quieter than the actual, like, you know, regular version of it.
You don't want that release. That release is shit. You need Steve 72's mix.
Well, and so the problem that, you know, with those people, they can only go so far without access to the master.
Yeah.
The master, right, tapes.
Yeah. There are limits.
And if you look into this, by the way, Alex, you may have some firsthand knowledge of this. Guitar Hero,
mm-hmm,
has sort of a weird special reputation in this space, because some of the best versions of these songs that are out there from the peak loudness wars era are on Guitar Hero, because Harmonix got the masters, yep, and to make a note track and to make a Guitar Hero track work, you had to put some dynamic range into that work,
into the individual tracks. Yeah.
And so the reputation, like, you can find, like, there's people who are like, yeah, no, this is the version on the album sucks, but the Guitar Hero version is saved because it actually has some range.
Yeah.
The infamous example of that, I think I've talked about this before, mm-hmm, but the Metallica album Injustice for All,
yep,
like, infamously has like zero bass in the mix because they had just gotten a new bassist after their first one died. And Lars Ulrich was basically being a dick and basically told the producer to like mix the bass out of existence. But I want to say there is a bass, much bass boosted version of that album floating around that came out of the Guitar Hero stems. Alex is nodding his head.
Yes. So the Guitar Hero Metallica versions of songs brought some of that bass back to the fore. I'm not sure it was like people were perfectly satisfied with it, but it was definitely better than certainly the album mix was. And I think the Metallica tracks that, the few that Rock Band actually got a hold of, had basically the same sort of reputation.
Was that people like hacking like the game install, like hacking the stems out of the game install, like extracting?
Oh yeah, that
them?
Happened instantly. Like, okay, whatever the you know, whatever cryptography they were using to sort of make it so people didn't download those things, that shit got hacked eventually anyway. Like even the Beatles stuff, which they were very careful about, all that shit's on the internet now.
And so, like, that's the issue, is like there's a lot of bands from that era where, like, the Walkmen are a really great band, and like good musicians, great singer, and but like you lose a lot of that dynamism just because they can play however loud or soft they want, the track doesn't change, it's all like, right, brutally leveled. And so when you're listening to good audio equipment, suddenly you're like, oh, this is like really the only thing I liken it to is like a desaturated picture on a TV.
Right.
Where it's just like, it's kind of gray compared to classical and jazz have been spared a lot of this. Classical, you literally can't do this basically and preserve the music at all, because like classical compositions are all over the dynamic range.
Right.
But rock just is like got a beating on this front.
You can loud your way through it.
So we were like, maybe the vinyls could help us.
Uh-huh.
They can't.
Okay.
So the Walkmen, no, like the vinyls still have some of these issues. It's maybe a little better. It's debatable. The argument for that is because you're making an analog copy, you can't torture the music the way you can digitally, where digital, like the digital file has to respond to exactly what you told it. When you're like imprinting something on a physical object, like there's limits to how much you can mess with that. So it can't perfectly import what producers do to a track into vinyl, so I have to make some compromises.
So you got to get your hands on the wax cylinder version.
Pretty much.
If it, in this case, didn't quite pan out, but it led us down this rabbit hole of two things. One is like, well, obviously we need a record player. So
no brainer.
We move to the new place. We have there's a record. There's a hi-fi shop near me.
Mm-hmm. Dangerous.
Very dangerous. And like, so I hang out there a fair bit and it's cool. I love it. I got a great deal on a Marantz turntable. It's awesome.
Can you replace the needles on high-end turntables?
Yep.
Just the needle?
No. You can. So the stylus is one part, and then like the whole cartridge, like the whole arm? The tone arm is the whole arm.
Okay.
And so these are really modular things. And we were talking about you can spend infinite money on these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The tone arm is one thing you can sort of swap out and you get a fancier. Because like I was talking to my guy who runs the shop about this actually like a month or two after I got my turntable. And he was sort of describing that like all turntable manufacturers, their physical ideal is like if you could somehow perfectly suspend the needle in space and it's connected to nothing except like it's magically sending signal to the audio output.
Right.
That's kind of the dream that there is no, there's nothing that can impede its vibrations. There's nothing, there's no like weight bearing down on the disc. It's just a perfect like playback.
Sounds like they need to start putting a gyroscope on the tone arm to keep it perfectly suspended. So it's making like the slightest possible contact.
Oh, that's step one. Okay. So they all did that. He showed me one. It was from a company, I think, I want to say Clavier. What they did was they suspended the tone arm, the gimbal, sits in what I can only describe as a vat of goo.
Great. Oh, my God.
Great.
And to be clear, upsetting goo.
Yeah.
Like
goo that shouldn't be.
Is this a color thing? Is it a viscosity thing?
It's a color and viscosity thing. Okay. But
sound
goo. And it's like in a sterno. It's like in a sterno cup type thing. Okay. You know, the sterno fluid.
See this. Can what's the name of this?
I think it's Clavier. Clavier.
Okay.
But. So they tried that. It kind of works. Then people swap out like their basic tone arm for like, I need one with the like flimsiest carbon fiber tone arm possible to save weight. And then you can spend, and then at the end of the tone arm, you got the cartridge. And you can spend, again, infinite money on the cartridge. And then you can, I think, also spend, you can swap out the stylus if you want. My guy sends all his cartridges to a dude in New Jersey to service the styluses. Cause he's like also this is the thing. So I started looking into this, like maybe I should learn to like maintain all this. No.
That was my next question. You were way ahead of me on all that. I basically was going to ask you, have you ever used a soldering iron? And if not, have you ever considered trying? Cause
a stylus is
smaller than
the wispiest nose hair you've ever seen.
In that case, I was talking more about like replacing tubes in your amps and stuff like that.
Yeah, it is ships in a bottle stuff with these. So it's like all vinyl people are like, they have their vinyl guy that they go to who will do the maintenance, but
because not just like any old solder will do, of course. You need
so small and delicate. Uh-huh. That's like, you know, the only point of comparison I can make is, do you know the little like wispy wires they use to connect to the USB ports on the front of a PC that are always just a fucking nightmare to actually get working if you're doing a build yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Everything operates at that scale and with that level of delicacy and that level of ergonomic impossibility.
Sure.
Except the difference is, of course, like with the PC building version of it, you connect it or you don't. It's going to work. It's not going to not. With this, there's degrees of how well did you get it. You can think it's hooked up and it'll be just completely fucked. So, you know, it becomes a whole thing. So, there's people who sell like turntables that is a selling point that doesn't come with a tone arm. Because why would you want a tone arm to come with the turntable? You'll of course supply your own tone arm. using your own cartridge.
That's just obvious.
Does anybody like make their own? Are there like bespoke like one of one?
Is like Neil Young in his garage, like just trying to make the ultimate tone arm right now?
You know, I think there are people like hand building, like the cottage industry. There's people I'm sure certain who are like hand building tone arms. I don't know if like cartridges, but there's so many manufacturers that like they might as well hand like. It feels like if they move more than a dozen of these things a year, it'd be shocking.
Sure.
You know, it's like who's going to spend like $10,000 on a record cartridge? Well, not many people, but the people that will are going to show up to this brand, and that's going to be who they sell them to. So we were launched on this journey of, so the vinyl can't salvage some albums, but regrettably, vintage vinyl can be vastly better than later digital releases. And this was, you know, again, I'm a child of like, you know, my dad is like a, you know, 50s boomer. So like a lot of the music stuff I came up with, like, you know, Warren Zevon, stuff like that, is sort of my go-to reference tracks for how does the sound. Mm-hmm. And so that's a good example of, you know, like you go and listen to some of these things on digital releases and you're like, yeah, it's I know how Excitable Boy sounds.
Right.
And it's like, you might not, because somewhere when they re-released it on CD, something got changed.
Right. So the version you're familiar with growing up might actually be an altered version from what, you know, was the original intention.
And this was the thing where, like, and this is how it becomes. And this is fun, by the way, because it is like you think you know a track really well, and then you go listen to the original like vinyl pressing, and you're like, "This fucking rocks!" Like, this is a track that I never thought about at all, and it's because in the CD era they just mixed it to amplify like the high end to make it brighter and sound more like high res.
Mm-hmm.
But then you listen to the vinyl pressing, and it is way more, there's a great band here playing with this. Like, that was the experience, like going to listen to Zevon on vinyl versus off digital. He has amazing, like, on his self-titled LP, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks are backing him up on Mohammed's Radio.
Right.
Like, the number of people who pass through that album, it's like a murderer's row. And they're kind of ducked down on the digital releases, and then you go back on vinyl and it's like, oh, they all sound fantastic. So now you're down the rabbit hole of like, I need to find more vinyl of classic albums before they messed with it.
You have to find the right audio.
Like, and the pre-digital audio, what you're really talking about is the pre-digital, like the unmolested actual recording, right? Before computers got into the mix, because I have wondered for a very long time, like the modern vinyl craze is a little weird to me, because like everything that's getting recorded and put on vinyl is going through computers at this point, right?
Yep.
Like nothing is, like, literally nothing on the planet, unless there's some random guy outside of Massachusetts with a studio in his garage or something. Like, nothing is getting recorded pure analog these days, right? Like, it's all probably being produced and mixed digitally and then ending up back on vinyl after it's already been through like the digital ringer.
There, so that's mostly true. It is possible that
there are some specialty studios out there that can still, I think, do stuff the old way, but they are usually like the most high end and expensive ones.
Well, and also a lot of mixing like boards are basically analog devices. Like, they might still be counted as like, oh, it's working in digital medium, but in terms of like the guts of that, it is an enormously powerful tool of like, it's enormously powerful, like, analog suite that they're working with that like inputs and outputs digital. But in between, a ton of analog shit is happening. That can complicate it, but by and large, you're mostly right. A lot of modern music is not being made with analog in mind. So then it becomes like, do you want the cool object of the record? And the answer is yes. Yes, I do.
Sure.
The other thing I'll say is this. 45 RPM records do sound fucking sensational. They're massively inconvenient. It's like, you want 12 minutes of music aside, and they'll be the best 12 minutes ever. But you're like, you sit down, like, two tracks play, you're back on your feet, flipping the record, all that.
Yep. That's why the 7-inch was invented, I guess.
Is it, what is the advantage there? Is it more fidelity? Is it because there's more space devoted to less audio? There's more kind of quote unquote resolution.
It's basically that. I think the grooves might actually be physically deeper as well. But yeah, you can basically, you're using the same amount of real estate to basically play what you have back faster. Mm. So it's a little more stretched out. So you can imagine like how much more detail you can pack in there, because now instead of a very small part of the circumference of the of that track, now you have a much longer space for the same amount of music. And so you can imagine like how much more detail, how much more resolution you can fit in there. But yeah, the compromise is it's a pain in the ass. But I should have just left it there. Had my dangerous like vintage vinyl habit now, buying stuff that I was like, let's see if this is life changing. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. But then my audio guy was like, you know, you should really, I know you're happy with the phono stage you've got, the built-in phono stage on the preamplifier, but you should really listen to a dedicated phono stage. You should listen to one from Gold Note.
Gold Note.
Gold Note.
And this is, he's tried to sell me on Gold Note stuff a few times. And mm-hmm. I'm like, I know going into this, my audio guy just loves this brand. Mm-hmm. And I kind of don't. I bought a music streamer from him, and I did side by side the Gold Note, like $3,700 music streamer, versus the Blue Sound Note Icon, which was like one third the price. And the Blue Sound sounded significantly better, because if you pull the spec sheet apart, whatever else is happening, the Blue Sound had a really nice S Saber DAC for each channel. And so like there's a little more hardware happening mm-hmm. there. It did, and it sounded better. It sounded better in the Gold Note thing. So like, I think they're kind of an audiophile brand. They attract a lot of hype. The prices are eye watering, which in some ways people will judge you by the price you charge. So I think there's a little bit of like, well, they have to be good if they're confident enough to charge this much for this. So I'm listening. So he sends me home with this phono stage, their PH10 phono stage. And I plug it in, and to be clear, I've heard some people describe the objects as like sleek, cool. This is beautiful, like hand-built Italian design. I know enough about electronics that like there's lots of this that's like pretty basic. If you look up the PH10, mm-hmm. Its screen is the basic controller interface you find for any sort of hobbyist electronics like project, right? It is like they make a million of these screens, and the interface is minimum viable product for something like this. And people are like, oh, it's so sleek. It's so fancy. And I'm like, this is kit electronics mm-hmm. grade stuff that you're talking about. That doesn't necessarily imply anything. Analog devices, like it is kind of the guts of the machine that is where it's going to live and die. If they don't want to invest in, you know, if a simple interface is going to get them where they want to go, fine. I plug this thing in and plug the turntable into it, and I put turn preamplifier on, put the input, and I suddenly hear like a buzzing.
Uh-oh.
And I'm like, well, that's not good. And their manual has a frequently asked questions like, hey, it's buzzing. And mm-hmm. they're like, well, it could be that there's like electronic interference somewhere in your system. This is a sensitive piece of kit. And I'm like, no. They also though have things where it's like, some of their things are like, well, there's so much gain coming from this thing that once you start playing the record, you won't hear shit because it's below the noise floor of the record. And so like, if there's like hissing or buzzing, just ignore it and see if you can't like just put on the music and it won't bother you anymore. It'll be fine because it'll play below the record of the level, which isn't a totally insane thing. Like if you turn to a phono input, you will hear a hiss. It's just an open line. Yes. But
yeah,
if for a manual to be like, well, maybe it's not a problem at all. I'm like,
if you hear a bad sound, maybe just tell yourself, actually, it's better this way.
Yeah, it's definitely that. I was like, I don't know about that. But yeah. So I hear this buzzing. I call my guy. He comes over and he brings over his, puts in a separate device, identical machine, separate but different device, and it's still doing the buzzing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, "Well, if you really want to test this, we should start unplugging stuff from your system." And so I look at my AV receiver, which is connected to the preamp, but is not currently part of the chain for the turntable. And I was like, "Yeah, let's unplug the receiver and see what happens." And I do that, immediately the sound drop. It's gone. And I was like, "Huh, okay, that's a little weird." And he was like, "Well, it could be something connected to the receiver. It may not be the receiver. You know, who knows." Doesn't matter. I enjoy my day of listening to records on this thing. After some fine tuning, it does sound really good. I don't know if it sounds like $2,500 good for the small amount of improvement it makes. I think it's a lot. Something that's doing a lot of lifting there is it is a known fact that louder sounds better, and this thing gains up the sound quite a bit. And so I suspect a lot of people are like, "Whoa, I've never heard this record sound this way before." And it's like, yeah, that's because it's just like coming in at like 7 dB louder across the board.
Right.
Like, it's not like you're just blowing out your eardrums and you're like, "Woo, couldn't do this with the old system." It's like, yeah, if you turn the volume knob up, you could have.
Yeah, I go through this sometimes because, like, I don't have great hearing. Like, my ears from drumming are basically shot in various ways. So the way I enjoy music now the most is by putting earbuds as close to my eardrums as possible and just making everything as loud as possible. That is how I enjoy music. I have to feel it now because otherwise it just doesn't really hit me the same way.
I got two impressions about Gold Note looking at their website.
Yep.
First of all, they are way into telling you how Italian they are.
So Italian.
Like extremely. Like,
have you ever known an Italian who wasn't?
All of their products are the Giotto, the Da Vinci, the Bellagio.
Mm-hmm.
The Giglio. The other thing is,
have Marvel comms attached to it.
That's kind of what the styling looks like, actually. Like, some of these things look like they are right out of Rome, actually. But
Rome or New Jersey.
Also, just like, how perfect is Gold Note as a name marketed to audiophiles? Because what does it imply? It implies that there is a perfect note that can be achieved. Like, what does Gold Note mean? But like the ideal note, right? And for people who are constantly seeking perfection.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what better marketing frame is there than to imply that your products will get them to the ideal that they are constantly questing for?
And you got the photos with their gear sitting on, like, probably Italian marble.
Right.
Like, tables and things like that. And it's like, that could be dangerous. My life.
They know their audience.
And it's like, yeah, like, look how beautiful and elegant that box is, floating in isolation, hooked up to nothing. Now imagine as part of your system with like 50 different like XLR and RCA cables crisscrossing each other. Elegance goes straight out the window. But so I have a fun day listening to albums, and I'm taking notes, and some places it seems to make a difference. Some really doesn't, whatever. But I'm still like, what was causing that buzzing? So last night I'm like, all right, we'll do a little testing and we'll
hunt it down.
I put it back to the turntable input on the preamp, and I hear the buzzing. And now I start unplugging things from the receiver. I can't pin it down. But when I unplug an HDMI cable, the buzzing's pitch changes.
Okay.
Huh.
And then MK is on the couch behind me, and she's like, "As you're moving around, the pitch of this thing is changing as you're moving your arm around back there." And I was like, "Huh, that's not great." And we start unplugging more things, and then it starts making really loud buzzing. Like, same buzz, but now it's like,
but by unplugging things, it's getting louder.
Yes.
Oh.
Which is really weird. And then the buzzing is so loud, I'm like, okay, this doesn't sound good, so I'm going to turn off the amplifier. Turn off the amplifier, which, to be clear, is the thing that sends power to the speakers that creates sound.
Right.
Powers out on the amplifier, the buzzing gets louder again.
I knew it.
And at that point, MK and I are looking at each other, and it's like, because the other thing, what goes through speaker wire is current.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we're sitting here, and she's like, "Does that sound like 120 hertz buzz to you? And I was like, it does sound like that. And she's like, okay, I'm going to stand behind you and you start unplugging things. But like, there is like rogue current now in the system somewhere. And it's like, and it's, again, it's floating free. We don't know where the source is. So now we're unplugging tons of shit. Eventually the sound stops. And there's a couple. So what it sounds like in some ways is a textbook, what's called like a ground loop. Something is not grounded.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Yep.
I've got a ground loop isolator plugged into this headphone amp right now.
The way. And so then you were familiar with this because MK, an electrical engineer, she's like, oh no.
Oh, okay. So she came by that 120 hertz by ear thing very honestly.
Yeah. She's like, oh no. If we have a ground loop situation in the setup, like what we have is the herpes of the analog domain.
Right. Cause it's probably like baked into your house electrical wiring or something like that.
You don't know. Like she's like, I've been there like in grad school, like you can be in a room with what seems like a pretty straightforward setup. And there's like, you know, 8 PhDs in the room and they can't figure out like what the fuck is causing it. Like, where is this coming in? And so it becomes like tracking these things down and diagnosing them is Eugene Hackman in The Conversation.
Right.
Like that is like getting to the bottom of a ground loop.
A reference that the Next Lander audience now can appreciate.
Yes, we have watch casted that. So everyone can see that now.
That's just in case anybody didn't watch that movie. You are literally tearing the siding off of your walls looking for a bug or something.
So the other thing is the way it got louder suddenly with things powered off. She was like, that scares the shit out of me because does that mean something's damaged? Does that mean somewhere in there, like something got damaged? Cause like it seemed like a lot of current now just sort of like roaming free in the system.
Which is to say that maybe whatever all those things were that were plugged in were absorbing some amount of that and now that it's unrefined form is powerful in a way that no one had expected.
Yeah. Did it go through now parts of these systems that it's not supposed to?
Right.
And so we're going to be like, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, this just changed the week because now it's going to be what was causing that. Cause you can't how loud it was.
You can't live now. You can't it's live your life now knowing that this is a problem.
Well, also you can't like now that you know it, like simply current was flowing uncontrolled, not to ground.
Right.
Which is a fire. Like there's some sort of risk there. That's not great. And so now it's like, well, now we've heard it. We have to pin down like what's going on there. And so we're going to have to pick apart the system. But the thing I can't. It's like the question I have is, did the Gold Note just expose an issue that was there already? That is the only thing with enough analog amplification that it like picked it up and then boosted it so that I could hear it now? Or did plucking the Gold Note in change something in the system?
Like it was too powerful.
Yeah,
I don't know. What else could it be?
Is the Gold Note just the canary in the coal mine, or did it like? Is it the thing?
Or is
that
it the coal
plague?
Fire?
Yeah, yeah.
Or was it the poison? did it poison the whole thing?
I don't know enough to give you information on this, but my inclination as someone who had to have the entire electrical system in this house redone because there was knob and tube wiring in this house when we moved in and we were like, we are not sticking around with that. That is a fire hazard. Fuck that. I'm inclined to say that electricity was probably already there in your system and the system, that thing probably just exposed it in a way that it had not been exposed previously. I think that's probably what it is.
Did you pull every single source device out of the receiver? Did you get to the point where it was nothing but the receiver plugged into the wall and the speakers connected?
And it got worse.
And it was worse.
And that was okay. So it is absolutely something between the wall and the receiver then?
There is a complicating factor, which is, and I forgot about this until I was in bed. There was a powered subwoofer connected to the RCA jack on the receiver.
Right.
And we never tested as to whether or not the subwoofer could have been, because it has its own power supply.
Right. There could be something funky there.
Right. So that's the other, like, we traced it all back to the receiver. It wasn't happening with the preamp or anything like that. It was something with the receiver. But now it's like, could it have been coming in over the subwoofer? So it's going to be a long diagnosis process, but it feels like one of those things where I could have lived my whole life. I just never plugged in that goddamn phono stage.
I know.
I wouldn't have known. And I'm not sure. And maybe that would have been bad. Maybe like low key, there's some attritional damage from whatever that issue was. But maybe not. Who knows? Maybe it was fine. But I wouldn't have known. And I wouldn't have been spending my week yanking apart this system to now try and figure out something that's notoriously hard to diagnose. Because they can appear and reappear with weird combinations of, like, sometimes you get a very clean, like, oh yeah, this one device is the source of it. But sometimes it is a combination of, like, these devices, or worse, the combination of devices, connectors, and cables.
Yeah.
And that's where the insanity comes.
Right. Because you have to figure out, you have to test everything with every cable and every possible combination and see if you can find, like, a particular source of it.
Yeah. So you get, like, you have a bank of, like, 8 RCA inputs.
So I'm with test you. I'm with you. Like, there is a part of me that thinks it's probably good that you are at least acknowledged, like, have found this to some degree, because, yeah, you're right. It could have some kind of, like, you know, over time, some damage within your electrical system or something else. There's also the possibility that this would never manifest in a meaningful way, and the next owner of this house would be left to deal with it, and you would have been none the wiser. But it's too late now. Now you know, and that knowledge is forever with you.
And maybe you're just going to save yourself more grief later by diagnosing this now.
Or drive yourself to madness, actually, one of the two.
And Alex, you're alluding to something that I don't like thinking about, but it's a possibility. It's possible this is not going to be solvable through anything with the equipment that's in the sound system, the home theater system. It's possible that this is a thing that traces back into the wall.
Yeah.
And into the, like, very old electric system.
That's what I meant about this problem being baked into your electrical or your house itself. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And so that's, like, the thing I'll say is, it's kind of like, this is the trade-off you make with separates to an extent, right? Like, it's a more complicated thing. You have more granular control, but it's modular. It's infinitely modular, which means, like, one thing can go bad and you can swap it out, but you're never going to have, like, the whole system brick all at once unless you have, like, some sort of huge, like, you know, power surge event. And so, like, things like this can be, it's one of those things where, you know, eventually we probably can trace this back to one or two factors and leave the rest intact. You know, you'll never have the, like, an over-the-air update just, like, destroyed this device and its utility. But there's, like, a level of, it's kind of like old cars where it's, like, you do need to, like, there's now a basic, like, maintenance tax that you're expected to pay with these things. And, you know, the whole, like, look, my audio guy is, like, selling a lot of his stuff through his shop right now because his wife was like, I have a hard job. And then I come home and there's a lot of stuff that, you know, we share with the kids. And here's the thing. I sometimes would like to just be able to turn the goddamn TV on and have sound come out of a decent speaker and not have to ask you, how do I make sound come out of TV?
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
And so he, like, one day I came into the shop and, like, there were gorgeous speakers there, like, incredible amplifiers. And I was like, yeah, this is all my shit. We're moving to a, like, I don't think it was Sonos. I think he was moving to, like, a Blue Sound system. But yeah, it was soundbar and wireless satellites type situation. And, you know, goodbye $12,000 like concert speakers, things like that. Because his wife was like, yeah, all this stuff is great, but, like, I can't just watch fucking Love Island.
Yeah.
Right.
So something you have to be very conscious of when you become a lunatic about anything. is how much of your lunacy you're inflicting on the people around you that you presumably care about.
Right. This isn't your personal sound chamber. This is a living room that other people have to use.
It's like home networking is another big one, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, of like, you need to make sure the internet is always working for the people you live with. Like, whatever insanity you want to do with, you know, custom DNS or weird customer like static routing or whatever, it's like, you should just, at the end of the day, the internet should not go down just because you are trying to be a mad scientist, right? Like, you want to just turn the TV on and make it play something.
I am lucky insofar as this. MK would never do that. Like, she's fundamentally like, oh yeah, no, I love the insanity of it. I love the, like, I love these extremes that we go to. I just don't want to deal with it.
Right.
Right.
And so she's like, the second the preamplifier came into the picture, and it's like, well, get like sound off the stereo speakers. Got to make sure the preamplifier is set to the right RCA input. And she's like, yeah, I'm not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just watch stuff with the center speaker only off the receiver.
Yes.
So like we're lucky insofar as that. And I'm lucky in that, you know, she looks at this problem and she's like, oh, I can fix this. She was like, I know about ground loops. Like, cause we may not get good answers out of this, but she's like, I'm actually kind of intrigued.
She's going to track it down.
Yeah. She was like, do I have your permission while you're out today running errands? Like, could I just pull the system apart and start testing? And I was like, I also want to do some of the detective work. So save it. But, maybe team that up. Can be our together activity.
At least you have someone with whom you can descend into the madness together.
Right. Like I would never want to be the person who's like, my wife is making me give up a lifetime's worth of collected. Now, this is a trap, right? Like he's going to get rid of all the stuff. The kids are going to go to college in a few years and he's going to get better stuff or something that you know,
the
you
child's
see
bedroom
that.
Will in fact become the personal sound chamber.
You
at
can,
a certain
you
point.
Can see the wind up for that yeah. coming. But, in the moment it's like, yeah, the good audio stuff is being chased out of the living room and it is being given over to lifestyle audio. It's filthy.
Is that the pejorative term? I was just going to ask, like, I assume soundbars are the persona non grata of the speaker of the audiophile world, right? Even a high end soundbar.
There are some okay ones. I mean, none of them are going to like emulate really great sound.
Well, that's
like the Sony one I have is like better at doing surround than some of the cheaper surround setups I've had.
I mean, like a soundbar is just an acknowledged trade off between convenience and quality because the speakers can only be so big, right?
Yes.
So the soundbars. I kind of hate soundbars.
That's fine.
Go ahead. You've got at least 10 minutes left to get this out.
Yeah.
No, it's just like they're... I think they kind of lie about what they can do. And I think a lot of... like because here's the thing. My beef is actually... people are like, oh, it's an Atmos soundbar.
No, it's not.
That means nothing. That means... like, yeah, that means it can play back an audio... an Atmos audio file.
Right, it might be able to take an Atmos signal and play it back properly, but...
right. It can't move sound behind you. It can't do like it can't like there,
it can
there's
fake certain things, yeah, I mean, but there not are, there the are, real thing.
There are weird, what is it, HRTFs or the thing that lets you kind of acoustically make things kind of sound like they're coming from behind you with stereo. But like, yeah, that only goes so far.
Well, especially like, so what a lot of soundbars do is they have side firing and up firing drivers. They sort of throw sound around. The up firing, the idea is it bounces sound off the ceiling and then it will hear it. It'll sound to you like it's from behind or around you somewhere. They play around with stuff like that. But my heart, before we were moving, we actually did go to a soundbar. We used a Samsung soundbar. It was really good.
Mm-hmm.
Sucked for music. And like not just compared to like the stereo speakers, like we also had the Sony Quad system. Mm-hmm. That is a great system. And crucially, they don't use a soundbar at all. It's just four satellite speakers.
Right.
And it sounds, they just fake a center channel. They phantom center. And it, deeply revealing system. It sounded better than a lot of systems I've used with a center speaker. But yeah, so like soundbars, I think there's a lot of people aren't aware of like the trade-offs they're imposing. And the soundbars augmented with other speakers can be awesome. But like... yeah, there's a lot of them that are just trying to convince you this can do all the audio.
No, and then that's no, it can't. And even the best ones really can't. But again, they're perfect for, you know, if you just want a cheap setup where audio is not coming out of your TV speaker, because all TV speakers are fucking garbage now and have been for quite some time. So it is a considerable step up from that.
Yeah.
But it's not going to replace a true surround setup, a true, like, built-out sound setup. It's just a much better cheap option than just, like, letting the tinny, awful sound come out of your TV speakers.
Yeah, which you should never do.
Which yeah, I did for too long, honestly.
Well, and crucially, like, the sound bar will be, like, you hook an HDMI up and you're done.
Yep.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's there's the a lot to recommend that. Having just yes. walked you through, like, I don't know why my life is falling apart, because there's well, like 50 I think we cables do, actually. Back here. Yeah.
It's a thing that just sits on the same shelf your TV sits on and plugs yeah. into one thing and you press a button and you're done.
It faces you and makes sound. Go.
Yeah, and that's hard to beat in terms of convenience. But then you know you put a little more time into it and you're like, well, I can't go back. And that for
and
me
then
is
you end up like Rob.
Yeah, you're better off not knowing. That's mm-hmm. that's the real thing is you are better off. Like, there's some people where it's like, I don't. You that sounds great. Like, I'm happy for you. Like, enjoy.
Yeah.
Because yes. you don't. Because the other thing is like, yeah, you don't want to. God forbid you have the experience. On my little nostalgia kick, like when we had the system really perfectly tuned, I was like, man, I haven't listened to Smashing Pumpkins in ages. Like, okay. I'm gonna fire up Melancholy. Well, that's not mastered well at all, is it?
That yeah, that one has a good. Kind of a funky mix on that album, if I remember correctly.
Anything Corgan touched, once he had any sort of pull with the labels, is a disaster from a mixing standpoint. Poison to band chemistry, poison to audio production, but
poison to the pro wrestling industry. Just everything about Billy Corgan, not great.
No. And so, like, I was like, yeah, oh man, I can't wait to crank up like Bullet with Butterfly Wings or like Tonight. And I'm like, oh, this
did sounds kind of muddy,
sound
right?
Like this? Yeah. It sounds muddy, flat.
This is so weird. I was just reading about Gish, about the recording process of Gish last night. And there was a quote from Darcy about, like, I'd never want to do that again, basically, because of how shitty and controlling Corgan was and that whole thing. That was their first album, right? Anyway.
It's their second album, I think. Was it their second? There's the one with Siva was the first one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that might be right. But it's just weird. I was just reading about that last night, and here we are.
I mean, like, Alex, you know more about this than I, but like, weird things happen to bands in the recording studio.
Oh, brother, do they ever.
It is a pressure cooker environment, especially like, you have some people who are like, cool, we laid it down, we're good to go, I'm happy with it. But like, the recording studio gives you infinite ways to tweak what things sound like.
And if you're a band that has just signed a major contract, you have an amount of money and time you have never had in a studio before. And while there are probably A&R people and other people occasionally putting the screws to you being like, hey, we need to get this done. This needs to go out. You need to go on tour and all of that. The just smorgasbord of options in front of you and the resources in front of you is extremely tempting to any musician that has never had access to that stuff before.
And like, real talk, like, especially in rock, a lot of these are not accomplished musicians. Like, they don't,
some of them are,
like,
but yeah,
but a lot of bands newly signed and all that, like, they don't know what the fuck they're doing. They haven't studied for this. They're not audio engineers. They don't have like music theory backgrounds, and they might have good instincts. They might have an idea of what they're targeting, but like, you have so many levers you can throw.
Yeah.
And like, to a degree, like, I feel like some of the reputation for a guy like Quincy Jones is, well, that guy, in addition to being a genius, also had the moral authority to tell you to like, get out. Just get out of my studio. I am going to take the shit you handed me and I'm going to spin it into gold. But
yeah, but that's really the thing, is it like, that's what having a good producer is for. Like, and you know, what a good producer is varies wildly depending on what a band's needs are. You know, there are some bands that Steve Albini was the perfect, you know, sort of like, the bandage for what they needed to get their music to sound right. And there were some bands that just could not work with that dude because of his philosophy and the way that stuff went. And so that's how you end up with like Urge Overkill and stuff. But like, you know, like Rick Rubin, his whole thing, I mean, he's kind of a hack in a lot of different ways, but his whole thing is like, I don't have any education in any of this stuff. I just know what I think sounds good. And while I think, again, he's kind of a hack, with a band that doesn't know what it's doing, sometimes just having a person in the room who knows what they want it to sound like is enough to keep you on track.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I will say, I mean, not to defend Ruben in particular, but like, having a really good ear for what sounds good and that being something that's consistent with what most people think is going to sound good, like, is a skill.
Yes.
Like, even if you have, like, no technical background or can't, like, articulate what it is that's happening, like, just what being able to say, yes, people are going to like that and being right, like, that is absolutely a thing you can be good at.
One of my favorite things, too, is, like, the subgenre of stories about people getting noticed by bands they've idolized and being like, hey, why don't you, like, come in for a session? Why don't you lay something down for us for that coming album? And discovering they never wanted to learn how the sausage was made.
Like, yep. Sure.
Like, a story I came across, like, a couple months ago was Mark Knopfler, you know, Dire Straits, like, world-class guitarist.
Virtuoso, yeah.
Was invited to contribute to a Steely Dan album. And he was like, fucking love Steely Dan. Like, hell yeah, this is going to be, like... Yes, absolutely. Like, let me come in. And they're like, it's not going to be too big a deal. You're going to play, like, you know, one, you know, a small sample on, like, a much longer track. It's not going to be a big deal. He's like, okay, cool. He's described it as, like, one of the most scarring experiences of his career. Like, 10 hours in a studio.
For one guitar bit.
Playing again and again and again and not knowing, like, what was wrong with that take? Okay, I'll keep. And he's sort of intimidated. Like, he doesn't, there's enough hero worship that he's like, yeah, I guess I fucked it up again.
Well, yeah, but Fagan and Becker are notoriously just slave drivers with that shit. Like, they are extremely exacting. And I've also heard, like, not always the most forthcoming with specifics about what they want.
Also, the idea of hero worship on the part of Mark Knopfler toward anyone is so insane to me to think about. But
Fagan and Becker are two guys that all those dudes love.
Huh.
Yeah. And even, like, I think Knopfler still is like, you know, but they are geniuses. Like, you know, I think we got there eventually. It was a really horrible process. But, you know, I would never do that to another musician. Mm-hmm. And that's the, like, but that other part of it is the inability to guide performers to what they want. And so it's like, I won't know it until I hear it. So you have to do this 100 times because we can't describe what it is we're guiding you towards. So you're just going to, like, fire blindly into the dark. It reminds me a lot of, like, the Balthazar, the donkey, movie, Brisson.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Hey, Balthazar the donkey.
Robert Brisson.
Okay.
Like, famous for, like, he was like, I don't want any acting to happen in my movie. So we're going to, like, we're going to reshoot scenes until all artifice of performance has been worn away.
I see.
Oh, God.
And that's how he directs people. It just sounds like fucking nightmarish.
Yeah. I can't work in an environment like that.
Yeah. That's, It's also fun to read about the flip side of this, though, when, like, you look at a band that is extremely well-oiled and just knows exactly what it wants and just does it. Like, I've been on a weird grunge kick, and I was also reading about Nirvana's last recording session over the weekend, which is what eventually produced the song You Know You're Right. Do you remember this whole situation? Like, that song came out in 2002. That's, like, 8 years after Kurt Cobain died.
Yeah, it was part of, like, an anthology that they were putting out,
They put it on, like, a greatest hits. There was a whole court battle between Courtney Love and the other members of Nirvana. Anyway, but, like, that might be one of the most exhaustively documented recording sessions in history because it was the last time Kurt Cobain ever recorded anything. And, like, he apparently showed up super late to the session, had the song. They ran through it 3 times just to figure out the arrangement and the parts. Then they basically recorded everything in one take. Like, like, his first vocal take is the vocal on the cut. Like, he did a couple overdubs of guitars and vocals. Like, they all did their parts in one take and then they left and that was it. And, like, and that made the song. Like, they did everything in, like, the shortest possible amount of time. And, like, it's kind of cool to also just see somebody that can just come in and kill it and leave.
I mean, that was supposed to be a demo recording was the thing. Like, that was not going to be the final album track, I don't think.
But a demo
at that stage sounds like a professional recording for most indie musicians. So.
Yeah, I should mention, I think Dave Grohl and Chris Novoselic, like, did the production on that song after he died. You know, like, who knows if that's what the song would have been if he had lived and handled it himself. So maybe not a perfect example, but yes, like...
But still, like, knowing what you want and getting in there and doing it.
Yeah.
Well, especially, I can't, like... Recording studios are enormously expensive to occupy for
even the
days or weeks on end. Yeah. And in the days of tape, where like every you're burning through mastering tape like the entire time. And so like literally thousands of dollars can be just like being wound through the spools every time you're doing this. It's ridiculous. And it's true. Like, there's no one way to make great art. Some people, it's like, I'm going to grind people to powder, and at the end of it, there will be great art. And it will be undeniably great art.
Yeah.
It ground people to powder. I would never want to be a part of it. Yeah, I would never want to do that. I'm much more like, in terms of like what I tend to admire, it's much more the like the session musician approach to things, where it's like, yeah, what do you want? Okay, got it. Boom, hit it. Want anything different? And then you're out.
Well, and that's the thing with like the Steely Dan example is a perfect version of that, because Steely Dan was basically Becker and Fagan and a bunch of studio musicians. It was the same studio musicians a lot of time, like the Porcaro brothers and a couple of other people they were using over and over again, because they were the best session musicians in Los Angeles. They were the guys that everybody wanted on their records because they could do anything in very short time. So I can see Knopfler going in there and those guys being used to just telling Jeff Porcaro, just do this and get it right eventually, and then eventually just knocking it out in a way they wanted. This is not a person who knows that process.
Yeah.
So he's not figuring out what it is they're not getting out of what he's playing, and he is unfortunately tortured over and over again because he can't find it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
I can't imagine, too, you're like a fairly unusual musician like Knopfler, too. Where it's
he plays guitar in a way that is not, it's distinctive.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Rob, got one more question for you before we wrap this thing up on this now all audio Ramblecast.
Mm-hmm.
I have a speaker question for you.
Yeah.
I've got just two floor speakers in the living room. Like, just stereo is all I've ever had.
Yep.
They are Athena's, which Athena was like a short-lived early 2000s. Like, it was another one of those speaker companies that came out of the MIT area, you know, like that greater
Cambridge, later. American Audio. Yeah.
Like, yeah. So anyway, like they're perfectly fine floor speakers. I got them off of Woot in 2008, and Woot was clearing out. It was after they got bought. So their stuff was being discontinued and cleared out, and they offered the entire 5.1 system on Woot at the time for like extreme cut rate. And at the time I was like, I only have room for two floor speakers. Just, I'd forget the rest. Like, I have kicked myself ever since, because I wish I had bought it just so it would be matched.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I thought for years about adding a center channel now to those two speakers, but like, I'm not gonna go out of my way to track down the center channel that came from this set. Do you have any advice if I were to get a center channel? Like, should I just get one and see if it sounds good with these things?
Or like, no. This is what you want to ask Rob about. I'm telling you.
Is there like a question? I'm like, I'm only willing to invest so much effort and research into this, to be clear. So I'm just curious, like, what's the shortcut to getting something that sounds good with the speakers I already have?
So there's a couple things. First of all, there is every possibility that for the price range you'd want to operate at, you are better off having those two speakers like function as it, what was called as a phantom center. If you have like three channel audio for the fronts, your AV receiver, if it's only got two outputs, will just split that center channel across the speakers. And that's why everything can play back stereo, just like down mixes everything into stereo.
Yeah. So this is a 5.1 receiver. So I could set it up with a proper center.
So if you're going to go, and honestly, here's the thing. I probably wouldn't add a center unless you're like having intelligibility issues.
That is 100% the reason is that the mixing on, because all the dialogue in movies and TV is on the center channel, and the mixing is shit in most cases. And like,
but you have no surround speakers. So you're just, it's just the three
two,
up front.
It's two. And now like all the Plexes and Jellyfins of the world are all starting, and Apple TV even has this built in now. They're all starting to add variations on what mostly is called like dialogue boost or something like that, where I think they've all finally realized, hey, we need to be like mixing the center higher in stereo than we have been, so you can actually hear what people are saying over explosions and music.
So here's the awful truth. I did an experiment actually like last holiday season, right after we moved here. I had two different center speakers and then no center. I did back to back three times. So two different centers and then just the stereo speakers splitting it. A bad center is worse than no center. So like there's a lot like, and center speakers are often cheaper. A lot of speaker manufacturers kind of treat them like shit. They don't take it seriously. They're actually, what the thing we actually want to make is the big musical showpiece, like stereo speakers. But yeah, we want to sell a set. So sure, here's a center speaker that we put zero effort into. We put in a ton of like tweeters and no low end because it's dialogue. Right. So that'll theoretically that should sharpen up and make it more intelligible. In actuality, it does not. It doesn't guarantee anything like that. So I'm actually a center speaker skeptic.
Okay.
A great center. Now, here's the thing. I did end up finding, I got an Aerial Acoustics CC3 center speaker. That was life-changing. Like, put that in, and immediately it was like, it is salvaging, like, dialogue that has been hard to make out forever. Like, Alex references, like, Thief has some conversations. The writing is really good, but there's times it's like really hard to make out. Heath has the same problem. Like parts of the diner conversation between Pacino and De Niro are an undertone. It can be hard to get. A really great center pulls that stuff right out and it makes it pop in a way that I was like, oh shit. Like this was in there the entire time. It can be fixed. The thing I would say is a great center looks a hell of a lot like a floor standing stereo speaker. They're big. Like it's one of those things where they know what they're marketing, which is people like, I just want to sit under there tucked away like a little sound bar. I don't want a big like stereo speaker on its side. That's too much, but that's kind of what you need to do. Especially if you think of it this way, 70, it's not dialogue on the center channel. That's part of it, but it's like everything is on the center speaker. That's why you can't hear shit.
Oh, I thought mixes typically were just putting dialogue in there.
75. They balance it higher on the center, but it is still like there's still music and other sound effects and other thing being balanced in there.
Okay. To be clear, I don't actually want a center speaker. It is just to solve the problem you're talking about. If I could keep what I have and solve the issue programmatically and still be able to understand what people are saying,
are you using?
It is it's like a 2012 Sony. It's nothing special, and I'll replace it eventually. But right now, it works for what I need. And so
here's my question. So if that Sony has pre-outs, so that'd be like RCA outs on the back. You'd still use it. Basically, what I'm doing with the Anthem, it's doing all the AV processing, but it could send the audio signal to a separate amplifier. And then you don't have to replace everything. You can get a nice amplifier. Oh, just driving two speakers, it's not too crazy. But they will be on like a dedicated like power. The Sony should have enough power, but like a really nice clean Anthem amplifier can really change the voice of speakers. And there's time like it's impossible to evaluate speakers in isolation of an amplifier because I've heard speakers that are like, these don't sound like anything special at all. And then you hook them up to a different amplifier and it's like choir of angels. So I would probably look at either slotting a new amplifier into the chain to see if I can give those speakers a little more oomph. If I can find the space for it, I'd be looking at some nicer ones. Like again, Aerial Acoustics is good. Bowers and Wilkins make some good center speakers. Although they have these like weird little MK thinks they look like little dicks and she's not entirely wrong. They're like these little like microphone shaped tweeters. They're super directional and it feels like you're almost like in the crosshairs of this thing. It'd be a little intense, but it can be good for dialogue clarity. A little
shotgun mic looking kind of thing.
Yeah. And so that's probably what I would do is the other thing is this, if there's vintage audio shops in your area,
in San Francisco, there definitely is.
These people love to talk about this shit and they love to like loan stuff out and take it on, test it on your system.
Yeah, okay.
That's how you they will get be you. Able to try before you buy.
Yeah.
And really some of the stuff you can't judge in a showroom.
I probably should have framed this differently because buying more speakers is actually my option of last resort here. If I can just solve it again with like, I mean, I have literally done mixes of a couple of movies myself. I mean, and by mix, I mean literally just running the audio through FFmpeg with the center channel boosted 30%. And that helps enormously. So like, if honestly, I can just like solve it on the software end, I'd rather 20, do that.
2012 Sony, that's probably not bad, but like, a lot's changed since then.
Fair,
I would actually look at a new amplifier, new receiver, because I think that could be a little more power. The last thing I'll say is everyone chases like insane power numbers. Like, oh, here's the wattage this can put out. That's kind of meaningless. It's really like cleanness of power and delivery and steadiness of delivery. So don't just look at the biggest like wattage figure for channel amplification and think that's going to be the way to go. Some of the best ones you can hear will have like really underwhelming top line numbers, but they are better. So that's I would probably like my first resort here would be a newer receiver because that's going to have a more modern processor on board and might have better circuitry. Okay. I would maybe the latest generation of Sony stuff is really good. Anthem stuff is really good. Marantz is, they've gotten their shit together.
Yeah.
People still unfortunately, like all these companies are owned by Denon. I would not mess with because Denon and Marantz are owned by the same company.
Oh, yes.
And
many such cases.
Oh, you know, this is everything has happened. Like the sheer number of speaker manufacturers that are owned by like Martin Logan, I want to say, is ridiculous.
That goes both ways. It's not just speaker. It's not audio out. It's also like production audio in stuff. Like I have a DBX channel strip that doesn't work worth a shit.
And I almost bought one of those.
And I do not recommend it. But when I dug into the warranty and stuff, and then I found out DBX got bought by Harman at some point, which I'm sure Harman also owns a bajillion
Harman
audio companies.
And, yes, they do.
And like, and everybody was saying like, yep, their DBX build quality went to shit as soon as they got bought by Harman.
So Denon and Marantz basically stopped being competitors once they're sort of merged under the same roof.
Oh, and then did it become a price stratification thing?
Yes. And so Denon is now
the lower tier.
Marantz, for a while, the reputation went to shit.
Mm-hmm.
But then the way the story is told to me, they like things went to hell in a handbasket at Marantz. The whole place was like implicated in their shitty new corporate structure, except the dude running Marantz turntable division.
Huh.
Everyone kind of ignored him and he flew under the radar. And then when everything had gone to shit and Marantz's customer satisfaction surveys were like in the gutter and the brand had been like visibly damaged since the takeover, when it was like, how do we clean this up? They went to the one guy whose division still had like a sterling reputation. And apparently in the last 2 years, Marantz has gone back to being like one of the best, places you can go. So I would look at them.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Yep. Audio. There's a lot to it.
It's complicated.
You know, I've always thought the worst thing about audio is you can't see it. There's only so much you can do to work with something that's invisible.
Well, you know, a lot of these companies put a lot into various meters and indicator lights so that you can see it, Brad.
Spectral analysis and equal. Yeah. Okay. Well, next time on the Ramblecast, maybe we'll get into that. Rob, thank you for joining us. This has been highly enlightening.
I hope it was helpful for you to get this off your chest.
Yeah. Sorry.
In a presumably safer space than your normal podcast, less
judgy,
perhaps a bit less judgment.
Listen, you sent me speakers that I am currently using right now. I will never judge you for your various audio picadillos because I have benefited directly from them.
Hey, those speakers, still like
good quality.
A great example of a vanishing market segment, which was like the entry level pretty damn good surround system.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a smoking crater at that. Like, this is a hobby that's completely given up on giving people like good starter options. And you have like one of the last great like starter surround sets that they made.
And I will cling to them like grim death. Let me tell you.
Yeah. That's a very good system. I'm happy. I'm happy to hear it's still getting enjoyed.
It is being well used.
Excellent. Great. Well, that'll do it for the Ramblecast this week. Thank you again, Rob, for being here. Vinny's out all week, but we've got a pretty normal week around here with a watchcast and streams and the regular podcast and all that stuff. So keep an eye out for all of it. And we're off next week.
Yes. All of us are off next week.
There will be a new Ramblecast, but not a new watchcast, correct?
Not a new watchcast, and there will also be a Never Been a Better Podcast in the main podcast feed.
As per policy, so keep an eye out for all that stuff. But like I said, pre-recorded new Ramblecast. We've already got that in the can next week, and then we'll be back the week after that with normal stuff. So we'll see you then.